This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, President Donald Trump wants to gut Great Lakes protections. His supporter, Attorney General Bill Schuette, keeps looking to the past.
This is about the failure of the Obama administration.
The Michigan Senate Majority Leader is skeptical about the need for open records laws covering the legislature and governor.
At the end of the day, I do believe this becomes law in spite of his skepticism.
Republican Congressman Tim Walberg sponsored legislation to stop states from establishing low-fee retirement savings programs. An investigative reporter thinks he knows why.
What's really going on is the finance industry is arguing against policies that potentially cut into its profit.
And the weather is wild, unpredictable. However, it looks like the sap is running. But what does a bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup do for a whiskey sour?
Makes it taste delicious.
That's right. It's the weekend. We've got a cocktail for you. But first, let's find out what's happening in the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. President Donald Trump's budget proposes cutting the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative from $300 million to $10 million. Earlier this week, Attorney General Bill Schuette was on the Lansing radio station WILS. Host Dave Ackerley asked Schuette about his recent visit with President Trump and then asked,
"Are you concerned about that 97% reduction, though, in the Great Lakes funding by the EPA with the current administration?"
Yeah, you bet. Absolutely. And where this really stems from is, Obamacare and the mayor of Chicago and the Illinois shipping interests really don't care about the quality of and of the Great Lakes and the freshwater. And what we don't want is to see the Asian carp coming from the Mississippi River up into the Great Lakes. That's really, we have to block it.
We wanted to follow up on that conversation. Attorney General Schuette joins us now. First, what does Obamacare have to do with the Trump administration's decision to cut funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative?
What I was attempting to say is that this is about the failure of the Obama administration and the shipping interests in Chicago and the mayor of Chicago, who really have turned a blind eye, quite frankly, to the problems of the Asian carp knocking on Michigan's door. And that's what I meant to say of the Obama administration. So the fact is the Obama administration has had 8 years to do something with the Corps of Engineers to put together a program to stop this advancement of invasive species into the Great Lakes and have done nothing. Of course, that one of the sorriest groups I know, and they have lagged behind, delayed, haven't performed. The point is, we've seen from scientists and environmental DNA and the whole issue in the Great Lakes Basin, where we've seen the Mississippi River now being a place where the Asian carp are coming towards the Great Lakes. And we need to do something to block and stop it.
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative includes a lot more than that. In fact, one of the biggest threats to the fisheries ever in the Great Lakes was the lamprey. And included in this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is $3 million for the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, which keeps the lamprey population down so it can't decimate the population once again. It also does things like wetlands restoration that the Ducks Unlimited group is going to do. It does beach restoration at two national parks. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of projects in Michigan alone, let alone the other Great Lakes states, that benefit from this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So are you in favor of it being fully funded, or do you agree with President Trump that it should be cut by 97%?
I stand by the Great Lakes, and I want to restore the funding, and I would hope that other Great Lakes elected officials would stand with me on that. I know that the Michigan delegation in Congress feels very strongly about that, and I appreciate the leadership of my Republican colleagues on this issue. And the fact is that, we have a special responsibility in Michigan. Part of our DNA is this special responsibility of having the pristine and purity and freshness of the Great Lakes. And so these programs you talk about are very important. And then this Asian carp, this invasive species issue, is something that we need to have some sort of environmental separation, Lester, which is the real key, between the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes, so that we don't get this advancement and march into the Great Lakes by Asian carp. And that's the public works project that is so important. But the Obama administration did almost zero in the 8 years. And what we need to do is let the Chicago and Illinois shipping interests know that they can't just ignore the significance of the Great Lakes, and we can't have Great Lakes in Lake Michigan be like the Mississippi River. This is a $7 billion economic issue for the Great Lakes.
Did you get a chance to express those feelings to President Trump while you visited him?
This is the start of the budget process, and so I think there'll be a lot of us pushing back. There'll be a lot of us who want to restore the funding on these Great Lakes Initiative programs. That's really part of it's part of Pure Michigan.
I'm just wondering, why did you, when you were asked that question, did you immediately start talking about just the Asian carp and the Obama failures of making sure that that project was put through? Why did that first come to your mind instead of talking about the larger issues we are talking about now?
Well, I think they're all important, and they're all large issues. And I talked about the invasive species issue because Asian carp is a real threat that's menacing and knocking on Michigan's door. That's why. All these issues are important.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. That's Attorney General Bill Schuette. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Joining us now, as they do most Fridays, are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a past mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. A House committee has approved a package of bills to expand the Freedom of Information Act to cover the governor and the legislature with a few exemptions. The bills would make our government more transparent to the public. Now, this has happened before, but last time, the Senate Majority Leader, Arlen Meekoff, buried it, and it looks like he might do that again this year.
I don't really think it's necessary. I mean, we already provide everything on our salaries, our benefits, our staff, every tax dollar is debated openly, publicly. I don't know what more it is that could be gained.
Majority Leader Meekoff says he is willing to take a look at the legislation when it comes to the Senate. Ken, Michigan is one of the only states where the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, doesn't cover the governor and the legislature. Why isn't Michigan more transparent?
I think we will be. What you're hearing from the Senate Majority Leader is some skepticism and maybe bordering on frustration over this. But I do believe he's going to end up bowing to the political winds, and this is going to get passed and become law. There's going to be some useful and proper exemptions in it. For example, communication with constituents. But at the end of the day, I do believe this becomes law in spite of his skepticism.
Vicki, as the Flint water crisis was unfolding, Governor Snyder voluntarily released thousands of emails, and we all learned a lot of important information about how the disaster happened. Frankly, I don't think most governors would have done that, by the way. With FOIA, the people might have known sooner, and possibly some of the damage could have been avoided. Why would Majority Leader Meekoff want to keep that kind of information in the dark?
I have no idea. There's been a historic reason why the legislature and the governor have been exempt, and that, you know, Ken already alluded to the constituent discussions. Both political parties don't want conversations on their plans to be subject to FOIA. So this exemption, there was another exemption that was added to the bill when it was in committee yesterday, and that exemption says for 15 days, legislative discussions in political parties, in their caucuses, and in their strategies are not subject to FOIA for at least 15 days, which takes out that particular concern that the legislature had about one legislative party wanting the strategies of the other. As it comes to the Flint water crisis, and before that, the Education Achievement Authority, there was also concern about how that was discussed and what happened to create that. There have been a lot of high-profile cases recently that have really brought to light the fact that we don't have sunshine laws. And you are correct. The public probably would have learned earlier that there had been discussions about lead in the water in Flint had there been an Open Records Act. We knew in the legislature at the end of 2014 that they were beginning to see problems in the water, but there were no FOIA requirements at that point. I think the governor did the right thing. It would have eventually been subpoenaed and then out in the public, and it would have taken a little longer. This whole problem really is a concern of the public and how the legislature and the governor come to decisions.
I find it interesting that FOIA did apply to the legislature at one time. It was stopped because of an opinion from the Attorney General at the time, Frank Kelly. He said he thought it was a proper thing to do at the time, but he wished the legislature would revisit it in some way. So I'm just wondering what you guys think of that. If we had it, we lost it, you would think that it would be important for many legislatures since then to fix that.
Lester, I have some empathy with Senator Meekoff's skepticism. I think it will pass, but I do think the law of unintended consequences is going to occur here, both in a good and a bad way. One good consequence will be that people aren't even thinking about. It's going to change the way communication goes on in the legislature and the executive branch. And I think there's going to be in the future greater reliance on what is now a very ancient ways of communicating by phone and face to face. They're going to avoid email. And I think actually that's a good thing. The bad thing is, in spite of this one provision that Vicky alluded to, the 15-day provision, my concern is not requests from the media looking for background information on how decisions get made. It's political adversaries, I think, are going to go on numerous fishing expeditions, both sides against targeted seats over a two-year legislative session. And frankly, I just think that's going to be mischievous.
There's no doubt that that would happen. But at the same time, transparency in government should probably override politics, in this reporter's opinion. But Vicky, we'll give you the last word on this issue.
I'm glad to see this finally moving. I have served in several levels of government, including on city council and as mayor. And we are subject at the local level to Open Meetings Act and FOIA, and it's never hampered our ability to serve our constituents and to run for election based on the issues. The deliberations of the legislative process should be open and should be available to the people. They should know how their legislature works. And the problem with Senator Meekoff's soundbite that you played is he assumes it's just all about money. And it's not. It's about intention. It's about how decisions are made, how the process moves forward. And I also agree with Ken that the idea of legislators actually sitting down and talking to one another is something that we've been missing in the legislative process since term limits. There's a lot of effort to move things and fix it quickly and not discuss the open consequences of some of the actions. And with a FOIA request ability and the sunshine laws, it will require people to begin to defend why they're doing something and to talk to their constituents about it and to the press. And I think that's a good thing. I think it will lead to more compromise in legislation. In the end, we will all have better government because of it. Massachusetts is the only other state that doesn't provide FOIA.
That's Vicky Barnett, a past mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former majority leader in the state Senate. Thanks very much for talking with me.
Our pleasure.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's a pretty good chance you've heard of the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. If nothing else, you might recall the 2008 Olympics in China and his sort of bird nest design of the Beijing National Stadium. Some of the contemporary artist and activist work is being exhibited at the Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park in Grand Rapids. Joseph Beckerer, chief curator and vice president of collections, joins us now. Ai Weiwei was under house arrest for 5 years, released in 2015. How was it that you were able to get him to host this exhibit so soon afterwards?
Well, we actually started working with Weiwei when he was still under house arrest in Beijing. And I made several trips to the studio. Colleagues went with me as well. And we built that relationship, a very strong relationship. And so when the opportunity came that he was released and able to work freely, we were more than ready and more than prepared to do it.
The Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park is the only place in America, in North America, to host this exhibit. You, of course, also have an installation that was already there, the sculpture Iron Tree. How significant was that acquisition in arranging this exhibit?
Well, you know, Iron Tree was really important for us. That came 2 years ago, and it sort of marked our 20th anniversary. And it was a work that we had been thinking about, and it was an artist that we had wanted to deal with on a permanent basis. And the planets aligned, so to speak, and the work came into our possession. The significant thing about Iron Tree is that it is Weiwei's largest outdoor piece to date. Most of his things are for interiors, for galleries. So the fact that we could have something permanently and permanently in the outdoors was quite significant for us.
So tell me what kind of media, a few examples of the kind of works are in the exhibit of these 30 pieces.
Well, that's an excellent question because Weiwei is a conceptual artist. He's really much more oriented towards ideas. And he is a maker, but he oftentimes relies on the skills and the abilities of others to create those pieces. So there are pieces that are made with ceramics. There are pieces that are made with bamboo and silk. There are pieces that are made with Legos. There are pieces that are made with ancient pottery, photographs. There's even two films in the exhibition. So it's really a very wide-ranging exhibition, and the content is quite compelling.
Yeah, I understand the exhibit is not limited to one gallery. You kind of let the pieces take over the building. Why approach it that way?
Well, I think that Wei Wei's done a lot of interesting projects in museums, and he was looking for something that would be a new challenge. And the opportunity, yes, to be in the galleries, but to go outside the gallery spaces, to go into the conservatories, to work in the plant beds, to work in the public spaces, is something that really intrigued him. And so he was quite open that it was more than just a gallery exhibition. In a sense, we basically turned Meyer Gardens over to him, more than 30 pieces as a part of the show.
So he was there helping to decide how the pieces would be exhibited?
No, we started this project when he was still unable to travel. So we did a lot that went through photographs, through diagrams. We even made films of our various spaces. So he had a very solid understanding of what Meyer Gardens was like without having visited here. When we were doing the installation, we did have some of his team here. We'd set things up according to the plan. We'd photograph it every evening. We'd send it to him, and then we'd get a response back the next morning if it was okay, if it needed to be moved, if it needed to be adjusted. So for not being here, he was very much here.
What does Ai Weiwei mean to the art world?
Well, I think that people in the art world understand that he is a creative force. He's very much interested in objects, but also installations. And he's a conceptual figure. But he's also very well known as an activist. And his work, his life, his activities are oftentimes around two very basic principles, freedom of speech and human dignity, human rights. You know, these are the things that keep him motivated, not only in China, but wherever he's working on projects.
What caused him to become arrested with house arrest for 5 years? What kind of statement did he make that the Chinese government did not like?
Well, after spending a period of time in the United States, he came back to China and realized that human rights were certainly not where they were in the United States, nor was freedom of speech. And you mentioned very appropriately in the very beginning the bird's nest. As he was working on that project and gaining a lot of renown, he was also recognizing many of the inequalities, many of the problems with the state that were occurring. But I think the major thing happened with an earthquake in Sichuan. He got very involved because he wanted the state to take responsibility for shoddy architecture, for the loss of tens of thousands of lives, including many, many children. That really prompted him to reach beyond his existing barriers as an activist. And so it was really his speaking out, his pursuit of truth and freedom of speech that put him on the wrong side of the powers that be, that led to his arrest, that led to his eventually confinement to a studio and house in Beijing.
The Ai Weiwei exhibit, Natural State, runs until August 20th at the Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park in Grand Rapids, where Joseph Beckerer is chief curator and vice president of collections. We'll have a few photos of pieces in the exhibition on our website. Go to michiganradio.org and click on Stateside. Thanks very much for telling us about your exhibit.
Great, thanks. Come visit.
Last week, I talked to James Holman with the conservative free market think tank Mackinac Center for Public Policy about the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. For years, the Mackinac Center has been critical of the MEDC, calling it secretive and referring to it as the state's corporate welfare arm. Joining me now is the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, Steve Arwood. Let's start with the mega credits, the Michigan Economic Growth Authority. These tax credits amounted to billions of dollars. There's nothing much you can do about that now except to hope that some of the corporations will renegotiate their deals, the ones that haven't already. The big issue is the fact that the governor and the legislature were surprised when the corporations cashed in some of those credits, and that surprise can really mess up the budget process. Why does that happen?
Well, it did happen. 2 years ago, we resolved that issue. As you know, in 2011, the mega program was ended by the legislature, so there's been no new mega credits done since that date. But the unpredictability of the mega program, the way it was structured, essentially the way it was put into statute, caused some of these pop-ups to occur. Particularly coming out of the recession. And so 2 years ago, we sat down with a lot of the major credit holders and said we've got to put some transparency and some caps and some ways to readily identify this in place. It wasn't a discussion about taking what the legislature had granted to them away, but more that how do we put predictability into the system? And I think we were very successful in doing that.
All of the companies, the corporations who were getting mega credits, or just a handful of them?
Well, it was the primary drivers in the...
The big corporations, then.
Yeah.
The automotive makers.
Well, what we call the manufacturing transportation sector. And I have to be very careful because the Revenue Act precludes me from disclosing. But the discussions were very fruitful. They were very accommodating. We now have a system where every year going into revenue estimating for the state budget, we know what these liabilities could be. And, you know, from a conservative standpoint, the way I look at it is if you assume that the entire, you know, universe of credits that are out there will be claimed, which is not always the case because some companies don't qualify in the year they want to take their credit, then you know what your maximum exposure could be. So it's been very helpful. It's history now. The program is over. It's just the legacy of maintaining it.
The Mackinac Center, again, we were basing these questions because we interviewed James Holman last week, so that's why we keep mentioning the Mackinac Center. The Mackinac Center also says economic development programs, or as they call it, corporate welfare, is hard to track because of frequent changes in the programs, what they say is a lack of transparency, and, quote, an abundance of spin and puffery in the information that is released, end quote. But it finds the MEDC has a poor track record of actually confirming grants to those corporations actually resulted in retaining or creating jobs, and that the state really, they wonder if the state really gets any return on its investments. What would an audit of MEDC over the last 10 years find regarding those charges?
Well, we were just audited, or we're finalizing an audit on the mega program and how we've complied with, you know, all of the auditing under the mega program that's required by statute. And there's, to my knowledge at this point, I believe that audit will be coming out in a few weeks. They find us in compliance. Going forward, though, I mean, many of these, you know, I'm not going to debate the Mackinac Center, but many of the programs they're talking about, I'm not quite sure what they are because most of them are legacy programs that we just operate under compliance. The programs we have now are performance-based. They're cash-based incentives. They're typically up front. They're contracted to, you know, the companies, totally in a public setting. And then they're complied with by various, you know, measures where if they haven't created the jobs that they said they were going to create, the payment is not made. So there's no long-term liability on this. It's done once. It's done openly. And there's no resemblance to the mega program in this at all.
Just this week, Inteva Products in Adrian announced it plans to lay off nearly 200 people after receiving a nearly $1.3 million incentive from the Michigan Strategic Fund last summer. So how does the state recover a million-dollar bet like that?
Well, we'll look at what the company did and what this does to their base employment, and then it will be reduced.
So they don't have the money in advance. It was just a promise?
Well, I don't have that particular, you know, business.
Well, let's talk generally. I mean, because there have been a number of businesses which received grants or other incentives. They went belly up or fell short of the promises of jobs. So how can your agency make sure that the state's, the taxpayers' money wasn't wasted on something? And, you know, how do you justify picking winners and losers?
Well, the argument that we make a bad bet on something that could go, you know, belly up, as you said, or experience some difficulty down the road or go out of business, we deal with that at the time it happens. Oftentimes, it's very difficult, as you well know, to receive something back from something that no longer exists. And that's why we use this upfront performance-based metric so that we're careful that the company is agreeing to, you know, create certain jobs by certain milestones. And if those aren't created, then the grant is not given. As to the picking winners and losers argument, that argument has been made for a long, long time about everything that not only us but other areas of government does. But I think It is important to remember, too, that it's a one-dimensional view. You know, Michigan cannot stand alone as an island and say, take the attitude that nobody else is doing this either. So I think it gets in, you know, it's a much broader discussion than just what Michigan is doing. If Michigan is doing something and other states are doing other things, there are a lot of reasons why, you know, the competitive nature of this business may change. And I think that's the thing that gets just lost in this argument on picking winners and losers.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, Michigan is in competition with all of the states, especially the Sun Belt states, and of course, for this region, Ohio and Indiana and Illinois. But I'm wondering, overall, when we send money or we invest money in these companies, taxpayer monies in these companies, is there a real payoff, a real return on investment that amounts to more tax revenue for the state in the end?
Well, I think there is. I mean, you know, there's obviously several studies that look at that. I think that what you want to make sure you're doing in a very responsible way is not do anything that you don't have to do in order to get that company to locate here. If there's a, you know, an appreciable gap between, you know, the cost of doing business or the cost of creating 200 jobs in South Carolina or any other state or Ohio, we look at that very carefully, and we try to make it a situation where they can choose Michigan for a whole variety of reasons, not just the incentive base. And you know, you locate those jobs here, those jobs get created, the capital investment is made. Down the line, you have a supply chain that you know, receives benefit of that. And I think overall, it's since, you know, 2011, 2012, I think it's been a very good balance. I don't think we're doing anything that is not necessary.
I was looking over your most recent annual report, and it talks about the state's performance as a whole, but it kind of gives you the idea or the impression that MEDC was the catalyst. And I'm wondering, how much credit can you really take for the national recovery and the bailout of the auto industry that's resulted in Michigan's recovery?
Well, I don't take any credit for the bailout of the auto industry or for, you know, the recovery of the national economy. And we certainly don't, quote unquote, create jobs, but we facilitate the opportunity for people to come and create jobs. I think the primary driver in our recovery is that our fundamentals are good. States that have gigantic, and remember, we're one of, I believe, two states in the entire country that doesn't operate a jobs-based tax credit program. We don't do that anymore. And if you look across what's been done with the reduction in personal or the elimination of personal property taxes, regulations reduced, corporate income tax replacing the MBT, just in a fundamental basis, if you don't have good fundamentals, you're probably looking at states that have very, very large incentive packages, because oftentimes large incentive packages are put in place to, you know, deal with bad fundamentals. So I think if you don't have good fundamentals, you know, then you've got a different set of problems. And I think we're doing really well.
Final question. You've seen these criticisms from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. They have been critical of the MEDC for a number of years. What's your response to the criticisms that they've leveled at you?
Well, it's expected. It's something I hear all the time. I think that a state needs to have a vibrant and an active economic development program. And I think it's also a very one-dimensional discussion, though. It doesn't take into account the work that gets done by our agencies and communities and, you know, the developments that we partner with local developers and communities on, or the fact that, you know, a lot of what we're doing right now in a more global way is trying to, you know, work on strategies to grow the state's population by working to, as fast as we can, to retain and attract and keep our bright young minds here. We lost a lot of people during the recession. It's very interesting that over the past couple of years, we're now seeing a net inbound of baccalaureate degrees into Michigan and frankly, are leading the Great Lakes State. So I think the business incentives are just one small part of what our economic development effort is overall. The live, work, play, the Pure Michigan activity that we conduct in order, you know, it's about wanting people to come here, stay here, work here, raise a family here. It's not just about business tax incentives.
That's Steve Arwood. He is the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Economists and others tell us most Americans don't save nearly enough for retirement. In Michigan, nearly 1.7 million workers have jobs where the employer does not offer a retirement savings plan. Two Democrats, State Representative Scott Dianda and Robert Wittenberg, introduced bills that would set up a Michigan Secure Retirement Savings Program. Representative Dianda joins us now. How would the savings program work?
Well, how this would work is this would be able to have people who are working at a business to be able to invest money, and they would be able to have this available to them. And this is the whole point, is to get our great employees that are working for businesses to be able to save for their future and offset the state's liability when people get on Social Security and that's their only source of income. We got to be able to establish something where they are encouraged to save, and this in the future is going to help us reduce the cost of state government when we're putting out resources for people that do not have retirement program. So I think that this is something that we want to create to make sure that Michigan workers have a future for a retirement so they can retire with dignity and they don't have to be on assistance programs.
Now, your bills suggest 3% of their wages being funneled into a retirement account. Some workers are living paycheck to paycheck and can't even imagine that. Would the workers be forced to participate?
They would not be forced to participate, and even also with the private business. This is something that is not a state mandate to any business, and I want to make sure that people understand that. This is something that would be for the future, and I think there's a lot of businesses that if they do embrace this, they are going to be able to have more long-term employees, better people that stick around and not start job shopping every time that, you know, there's another job opportunity for them. So I think this is so key and important to be able to focus on Michigan and get people in the mindset of saving money again. We got to look at the 1940s and 50s when the government started telling people to buy savings bonds to invest in the country and their future, and I think this is the same idea where we're trying to go.
So I want to get back to that 3%. Could a worker decide, well, look, I can't see my way to 3%, but maybe I can do 1%. Would that be allowed?
That would also be allowed. It could be allowed. We could have it set up for anything that they could afford to do, and as they continue to grow in their job, they might have raises that are coming, and they'd be able to invest that money. And we all know just by putting away a little bit of money to save for the future adds up in a big way. You know, that's just known for our common sense approach to saving money, and when you sit down with an investor, they tell you the same thing. Start small and you continue to grow, and the one thing we have on our side is time to be able to grow assets.
I understand one of the bills offers a tax credit for low-income workers if they participate. What would that amount to?
The tax credit part would be an issue where we would be able to give them an assistance of $500. That claims 50% of their tax that they federally receive. So, you know, to be able to have a tax credit off the federal level would be something that's very important for those folks to see, to be able to invest in their program.
Well, as you know, a lot of people are skeptical about the government handling anything. So what would be the state of Michigan's role in managing the retirement savings program?
Well, the Retirement Association, I mean, they could be able to put their own money into any type of system that they want. It can be the private sector, and that's one thing that I thoroughly agree on, is that this has to be done on a private sector investment where the state doesn't have to handle any of the money to be able to have that into private equity funds. Or if this bill goes through the process and if we see a need to set it up through the state, we also could do that with an IRA type of program.
Republican Congressman Tim Walberg is involved in an effort to block federal rules that we're making it easier for states to start savings plans like the one you want to create. He says the U.S. Department of Labor created a regulatory loophole that would force workers into government-run individual retirement accounts without consumer protections. How does this decision by Wahlberg to do this affect your plan for Michigan's Secure Retirement Savings Program?
It's sad to say that we have a U.S. congressman that would want to block to have the state's right to operate any type of a program to make our residents be in a better spot for retirement, to be able to encourage people to save money. So I find it kind of bad that, you know, Congressman Wahlberg would want to hinder our state's right under the Constitution of Article 4.
Why do you think he's doing this?
Well, I think that it's a good headline right now. It's, you know, still it's going to get to be silly season. It starts campaign season, starts early every year. It doesn't matter what month it is in the calendar.
What are the consequences to the state if this doesn't get passed or it's blocked by this federal rule?
Well, what happens to the state would be the fact that we are going to have to put more resources in the future to be able to have people that are going to retire just on Social Security. They're going to be there at the line for our programs on the state level. We're still going to have to make sure that they're, you know, in a spot where they can afford to eat. And, you know, the biggest thing for retirees is the cost of the utilities in Michigan. It's the cost of food. It's the cost of their medication. And anybody now that we can get in the next 35 years to start saving money, to start taking care of their own business and their own life is a good plan. And I think that's all about why we live in this country.
Representative Scott Dianda is co-sponsor of legislation that would create a Michigan Secure Retirement Savings Program for workers who employers don't offer a 401k. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Thank you, sir.
So as we're talking about, Republican Congressman Tim Wahlberg of Michigan's 7th District sponsored a resolution that blocks states from setting up that voluntary retirement account we've been talking about. One of the advantages of that kind of account would be the lower fees for managing an account. A recent report in the International Business Times suggests those lower fees are behind the reason to block the state retirement accounts. David Sirota is investigative's editor and author of that news report. The whole idea of this Obama-era rule was to allow states to create these low-cost alternative retirement savings programs. So why would that be something Congressman Wahlberg would want to block?
I guess the answer, part of the answer, could be about what the financial industry wants. The financial industry, the private financial industry, has lobbied against these plans in states across the country, in part because the financial industry could potentially lose business or face more competition for its services from these public option, publicly administered plans. Congressman Wahlberg has gotten a significant amount of campaign contributions.
Right.
You cited
data from the Center for Responsive Politics that shows that he's gotten more than $500,000 from the industry, one of his top donors. I mean, how likely is it that the finance industry folks have lobbied him to block the state retirement savings plan simply because they'd lose out on those management fees?
I think we can presume that as a subcommittee chairman in a powerful role overseeing policy that affects private and public pension plans, that the financial industry has likely been in touch with his committee staff. Why is he moving to try to prevent states from doing this? I mean, it's anybody's guess. It's hard to get in somebody's head. But I think we can say for certain that the finance industry has fought these plans in states. Some states have passed these plans despite that opposition. And now the finance industry, which is very powerful at the federal level through things like campaign contributions, is now operating in Congress to try to push Congress to block these plans. Now, to be clear, the finance industry doesn't necessarily overtly say, hey, listen, we're trying to block these plans because it could be more competition for us. They have made arguments that, for instance, they've said that these plans at the state level do not get the same kinds of consumer protections as plans that are under the so-called ERISA law at the federal level.
I mean, the Obama administration rule said that ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Safety Act, was a roadblock to these state retirement savings plans. Why would the Obama folks want to skirt around a plan that's intended to keep retirement savings safe?
Well, because that law is a very Byzantine law. And the argument from the proponents of these state plans is that that law imposes reporting requirements and other kind of requirements on them that they argue are already enshrined in state law and they argue would make it too cumbersome for states to administer. So the proponents basically say this is, look, we're not trying to get around consumer protections. We're trying to basically get around bureaucratic things that make it harder to implement at the state level. I think the tell, the thing that you can see a sort of bait and switch in the arguments from those citing this law as a reason to stop these plans. Congressman Wahlberg, for instance, has said, I'm concerned that state plans won't have these ERISA protections. The problem with that argument is that the finance industry and Congressman Wahlberg are also arguing that other ERISA standards are not applied in other ways, this fiduciary rule. There's a separate rule about financial advisors and their obligations to clients. The rule proposes to say that ERISA standards to protect consumers should apply to financial advisors. So you've got a situation where the finance industry is saying, we don't want those ERISA standards over here to protect consumers in the financial advisory role, but we're really upset that there may not be ERISA protections at the state level. The thread that connects these two things together is what's really going on is the finance industry is arguing against policies that potentially cut into its profits.
David, let me stop you there. Let's hear from Congressman Wahlberg when he was talking about why he wants to repeal this this rule.
The goal of this resolution is simple. It is to uphold protections Congress, including members of both parties, has long afforded retirement savers. Today, we can close a regulatory loophole that would be detrimental to the retirement security of hardworking Americans, and we can ensure retirement savers in every state continue to have the same protections under federal law.
And the Heritage Foundation, as your story notes, issued a report arguing that very same thing. The state plans could strip retirees of critical protections. And very shortly after that, that's what Congressman Wahlberg is making the same argument. You wrote up a follow-up piece on this topic showing that 31 out of 32 Republican members of Congress from eight states that currently have retirement savings plans voted to rescind that federal rule that protects those plans. What happens to the people who already enrolled in a state retirement savings plan now?
That's a great question, and I don't think we know. If Congress does roll back the rule that allows these plans, those plans would then be subjected, presumably, to regulatory efforts at the federal agency level to eliminate them. That is to say that the plans won't suddenly cease to exist, but it would effectively empower the Labor Department or class action lawsuits by the finance industry to try to get rid of these plans, to legally invalidate them and shut them down. So this would be a first step to opening up that possibility.
One final thought on this. According to Retirement Equity Lab at the New School, using the U.S. Census Bureau's Community Population Survey, of the 161 million workers in the U.S., more than half, 54.2%, that's 87 million workers, do not have access to a retirement plan at work. Even people with 401ks generally won't have enough money to retire comfortably. What's going to happen to, well, over half the population in their retirement years?
Well, that's the big question, I think, one of the biggest economic questions facing the United States right now. I mean, to be clear, the state-based plans that we're talking about allow workers to contribute to a 401k-style plan administered at the state level with lower fees in many cases than they can get in the private sector on the private market. But, and this is a very big but, that doesn't solve or even nearly solve the retirement crisis in the United States, because the retirement crisis in the United States is both one about high fees charged to the savings that are already being accrued, but also one about a lack of savings. These plans are not proposing to put more money into savings, more money from employers or more money from government programs into retirement savings. And the retirement crisis is certainly as much and a lot more about how much total money is being put into retirement savings. And that's a problem that has not been solved or really, in many cases, not really addressed at all.
And one of the things about the fees that I read recently was that in a typical worker's 401k, the lifetime, there could be up to $70,000 worth of fees. That's amazing.
Right. And that cuts into, obviously, cuts into retirement savings, the savings that are necessary to subsist in retirement.
David Sirota is the investigator's editor at the International Business Times. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We reached out to Congressman Tim Walberg for an interview. He declined our request.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. And we've been seeing a little weather, a little spring-like weather. Did that put you in mind of a drink?
It did, because I heard that the maple trees are running and that syrup season has started.
Oh, so I guess that's a key ingredient this time.
That's right. We are going to use a great Michigan maple syrup out of Grand Rapids from Bliss, and it is actually aged in bourbon barrels, so it's extra appropriate to our cocktail today.
Maple syrup aged in bourbon barrels. What does that do for it?
Makes it taste delicious.
Okay. Well, tell me about the drink.
All right. So this is just a little whiskey sour variation. So we've got a rye whiskey. We used 1.5 ounces. You could use 2 ounces if you like a little bit more punch. We used 1/2 ounce of the maple syrup. And you don't have to use Bliss. You could use whatever local maple syrup you have. And then just 3/4 ounce of lemon juice to counter that sweetness. And then an unusual ingredient, which also, of course, brings to mind spring, and that's an egg white.
All right, I've heard of egg white in cocktails. I've had some, but what does it do for a drink?
Mostly it just adds texture, the same way when you make a meringue, anything that has a beaten egg white in it, it adds lightness, it adds texture. So that's predominantly what it's doing here. But it's also giving us a beautiful canvas on the top of our drink to be able to garnish it really nicely. And so we did a few drops of Angostura bitters on top and dragged a toothpick through them to really get a nice pattern on the top of the drink. So a couple different things it does.
All right, how do you make it?
When you're using egg whites in cocktails, you have to add a little extra step. In addition to our normal shaking, before we add the ice, we're going to shake it on its own without any ice. So we have all of our ingredients, including that egg white, and then you're going to shake that for about 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and you'll actually feel it start to change. As you shake it, you'll feel that egg white starting to thicken up. And then once you reach that point, then you open it up, add some ice into the shaker, shake it good and hard because you want to get that nice froth on top. Nobody likes a slimy egg white in their cocktail. And then strain it into the glass.
All right, going in, let's see what this is about. It's sweet, but it's not as sweet as I thought it might be with, pure maple syrup in it.
Maple syrup is sweeter than simple syrup, so the recipe that we use for this has less maple syrup than if we were using simple syrup as our sweetener. That egg white also acts to kind of round out some of those flavors, so it kind of evens out the drink.
You know, I've actually only been out to the Sugar Bush once in the spring. Apparently, you have some good memories with that.
I do. When I was a kid, we would go every year as part of a school trip, and I remember loving to see the maple syrup boiling down. And so it's a really great memory for me. I love maple syrup because of it, and I think this is a nice alternative to putting it on pancakes.
Well, thanks for making it for us.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Rusty Brock was our audio engineer today, and he tore apart my computer in a good way. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.